Hello, my name is Rob Bennett. I'm the author of a book entitled Passion Saving, The Path to Plentiful Free Time and Soul-Satisfying Work. I'm also the publisher of the PassionSaving.com website, and I'm working on a second book entitled Investing for Humans, How to Get What Works on Paper to Work in Real Life. This is podcast number 92. I'm recording it on Wednesday, February 4th, 2009. The P10 level today is 14. That's fair value. Stocks purchased at today's prices offer a strong long-term value proposition. The music for the podcast is by Kevin McLeod at the Incompetech.com website. And the name of this selection is On the Passing of Time. The title of the podcast is The Market Has a Brain. That's why whatever you decide to do turns out to be wrong. This podcast falls into the group where I try to explore, I don't know what you'd call it, not conventional wisdom exactly, but basic questions that occur to people that seem very almost simple-minded. When people put these sorts of comments or observations or questions forward, they often apologize, and I feel that they contain great insights or great truths in them if they are explored seriously. And I did a podcast on one of these. I don't recall the exact title, but it was basically when stock prices crash, where does all the money go? That's the most wonderful question you can ask about stocks. If you ask, and people always ask it after a stock crash. I always see this. And usually the experts come in and they offer these trite answers. But if you answer that question seriously, you can open up your mind to all sorts of things about stock investing that you never understood before. That's an earlier podcast, a ways back. But this one is based on something, and you hear people say this all the time. They'll come onto discussion boards and they'll say, oh, yeah, they're telling a joke, but they'll say, I just had a bunch of money come in and I put it into the market today. And so everybody can rest assured there's going to be a big price crash in the next week. Or just the opposite. They'll say, I've taken all I can take. I'm taking my money out of the market. So everybody else can feel comfortable. There's, prices are going to go back up starting tomorrow. And it's a rueful sort of comment. And it's it comes from a healthy place because it comes from a feeling of humility. People have experienced that what they think is going to happen is often wrong. And they're honest enough with themselves to acknowledge that. People who make that sort of comment are not trying to portray themselves as know-it-alls. And I think that's a very healthy perspective. So it comes from a healthy place. But if you take the comment seriously, and it's not intended to be taken entirely seriously. People say this as a joke. But they're saying it based on experience, and many people really do have the experience that whatever they do is wrong. Whenever they think stocks are going to go up, they go down. And whenever they think they're going to go down, they go up. And frankly, this is a big part of the appeal of passive investing. It's a big part of the psychological appeal, because what passive investing portrays itself as, it portrays itself as neutral. And so the idea is, it's sort of, part of the marketing pitch is, are you one of those people who always get it wrong? Every time you think you understand stocks, it turns out to be wrong. Well, have we got an investing strategy for you? With passive investing, you can't be wrong. Because you never make any decisions. You never change your stock allocation. So you're set. That's part of the marketing pitch. That's part of the appeal. Part of the emotional appeal of passive investing. And so I think it's worth examining this question. Is it really true that we always get it wrong? We can't always get it wrong. Obviously, we have to get it right some of the time. But do we get it wrong more than we intuitively would think would be the case? Presumably, if the market were random, which is which at root is what passive investing assumes. The reason why they tell you you can't beat the market is there's sort of a premise there that the market is random. You can't know anything about it, and therefore, if it's random, you should be able to get it right 50% of the time. If you make decisions about the market, if you try to beat the market, you should have a 50-50 chance of beating it and a 50-50 chance of not beating it. But most of us, our experience is it's less than 50-50. Our ability to beat the market is less than 50-50. And that doesn't seem right, but that seems true to our experience. I think it is true. I think we do. There is a reason why we get it wrong more than 50% of the time. Now, that's the premise of this podcast. And how could it be that we could get it wrong more than 50% of the time? For us to get it wrong more than 50% of the time, the market would have to have a brain. The market would have to have some way of knowing what we did and then do the opposite. Otherwise, it would be random and we would get it right 50% of the time. But how could the market possibly have a brain? The market isn't a person. The market doesn't have a brain in a real sense. But the deeper reality is that the market does have a brain. The market is people. The market is us. That's all the market is. People get intimidated by it. This is why people turn to experts. They think, oh, the market is so complicated. I could never understand it. There's these charts and tables and numbers and equations, and how could I ever understand it? All the market is us. The market is people. It's people that set stock prices. And people have brains. So the market has a collective brain. The market borrows our brains. So the market does have a brain. So that suggests all kinds of things. One thing it suggests is if the market has a brain, the market is predictable. Or at least it can be. A brain responds to inputs and to feedback and to stimuli. And a brain responds to the inputs and the feedback and the stimuli in a rational way. That's what a brain does. If the market has a brain, the market is at least in part predictable, which means you can beat the market. And if the market has a brain, it is indeed possible that you could be getting it wrong more than 50% of the time, more than you would randomly expect. There can be some truth in this observation that whatever you do is going to turn out to be wrong if the market has a brain. And I say it does. The market borrows our brains, the collective brain of all investors. What makes this conversation go around in circles is that the market is it's not a hard to understand entity. People think it's hard to understand. It's not nearly as hard to understand as people think. But what it is it's unusual. The market is an unusual entity. The market is a combination. The market makes decisions based on two things, reason and emotion. And those two things are in total conflict often. I suppose there are times when they're not in conflict, but they're often in conflict. What your reason tells you to do and what your emotion tells you to do are often in conflict. And the entire trick to understanding the stock market is understanding that reality and then accepting it. And I think that seems to be one of the hardest things for human beings to do. Human beings tend towards one or the other. They And what happens through stock market history over and over again is that people get all caught up in the idea that the market is rational. That's what the efficient market theory says. The efficient market theory says the market is rational. It's always rational. It's 100% rational. That's why you can't beat it. The market has a brain and the market is smart. And the market has figured out anything you could come up with and you think that you can do better, you're wrong, because the market is smarter than you. You're not going to beat it. But it's not true. The market is plenty smart. But the smartest person in the world, if they have emotions, can make horribly bad decisions. So the market is also emotional. As smart as it is, and it is smart, it's emotional. Bob Dylan has a line. I don't really understand the line in the High Water song. It's a very good song on a recent album, and he says, "As smart as you are, man, you'll never be smarter than yourself." It's "As great as you are, man, you'll never be greater than yourself." But I almost feel he could be talking about the market. As smart as the market is, it can't be smarter than itself. It sounds crazy, but the market is smart as all get out. It really does take into account, the market brain takes into account all these inputs from millions of people, millions of smart people. So the market is super smart. But the market is also super dumb, because all of those millions of people also have emotions which cause them to make decisions that are not smart. And the market takes all those into account too. So what the passive investing model tells us is, oh, don't think you can go against the market, because that market is so much smarter than you. There's no way you could beat it. And all that is true. But they leave out that the market is also so much dumber than you, that if you just hold on to your common sense, you don't need to read lots of books, you don't need to manage any big funds. If you just hold on to your common sense, you sail above the market. You can be far smarter than the market. Both things are true. The market is very, very, very smart and very, very, very dumb. And what people have a hard time doing is integrating the two. People tend to go to one extreme or the other. During a bull market, people think, oh, the market's so smart, and I'm not going to try to beat it. I'm just going to leave my money in. I'm not going to take my money out just because prices are insane. If the market thinks those insane prices are good, they're good. I'm not going to outsmart the market. I'm leaving my money in. And then when we see the consequences of that, which is a huge price crash, and everybody loses all their retirement money, then people say, oh, the market's all bad. The market's all emotional. Market is not smart. I'm not putting my money back in the market. I'm taking it out and I'm keeping it out. I'll never put another penny in the market. Then the market's all emotion. But the truth is that the market is always both things. Always. Whenever you start thinking the market is smart, you need to remind yourself that the market is dumb and emotional. And whenever you start thinking that the market is dumb and emotional, you need to remind yourself that the market is smart and rational. That's the trick. The trick is achieving emotional balance. That's the trick. That's the whole trick, really. You reduce, you know, whatever, I've got, this is podcast number 92, and they're all about an hour long, 92 hours of material, and that's what it all comes to. If you want to be a successful long-term investor, you need to acquire emotional balance. And so when you find yourself asking this question, why is it that whatever I decide to do always turns out to be wrong when it comes to stock investing? Ask yourself, take the question seriously. Is there a reason why that happens? And I think there is. Now, I'll give some examples. Poor Taylor Larimore. I'll pick on poor Taylor Larimore again. Not because I don't like Taylor. I actually do sort of like Taylor. But Because Taylor once gave a great answer. One time, I don't know if I've told this before in a podcast. I may have, but Taylor Larm was the co-author of the book, The Bogleheads Guide to Investing. He's one of the big shots over at bogleheads.org. But when he was at Vanguard Diehards and I was posting there, one time Taylor gave the perfect answer. And I forget what he said. You know, he made one of these dogmatic statements that the passive investing dogmatists always make. And I said, Taylor, are you sure? You know, it might have been, he said, timing doesn't work, something like that. And I said, Taylor, are you sure? You know, rather than getting into a long thing about the data says this and all that, I just said, are you sure? And he says, you can never be 100% sure. And I said, Taylor, my man, my comrade, my friend, that's the right answer. Taylor's allowed to have a different viewpoint than Rob Bennett, but he's got to calm down on all the dogmatic stuff. He doesn't know for sure. He thinks he does. But thinking you know for sure and really knowing for sure are two different things. And the day Taylor Larimore is God is the day I'll just take his word for it. But, you know, until that day comes, he's got to present evidence, and his evidence doesn't persuade me. And there's no reason we shouldn't be friends. But anyway, what was I going to say about, oh yeah, Taylor, you know, something that always, a story about Taylor that always hit me was that he told a story once about how he discovered passive investing. And, you know, and he said, oh, you know, I used to do, I don't know what all his strategies were, but he had all these different strategies he followed through his life, all get rich quick schemes. And he admits that now. But he'd follow them and he'd lose all his money, and then he'd go on to another get-rich-quick scheme and he'd lose all his money. Then he says, then I discovered passive investing and now I understand how investing works. And, you know, this is why he's such an advocate. This is why he knocks himself out explaining it to other people. He believes in it with his heart, mind, and soul. But the way I, you know, with my X-ray vision that I have as a result of being a confirmed rational investor, my take on it is he just found a bigger get-rich-quick scheme. That's all. He doesn't know it. But that's what I believe. And in other words, he's just a person who, for whatever reason, his personality is drawn to get-rich-quick schemes. But when you ask, you know, if Taylor were to ask himself, why is it whatever I do is wrong, that would be the answer. In other words, if you have a personality type that is drawn to get-rich-quick schemes, and I'm not trying to ridicule Taylor, please understand that. I'm using him as an example. He's the author of a book. I think it's fair to use him as an example. If his ideas are you know, causing financial ruin for the people who read his ideas, I think it's fair to point out the fallacies. But for whatever reason, you know, he's got a personality drawn to these sorts of things. And boy, passive investing is just tailor-made for him. Because it's the biggest get-rich-quick scheme of all. But he doesn't see it. Nobody would ever fall for a get-rich-quick scheme if they knew it was a get-rich-quick scheme. It's the nature of the enterprise. Have you ever heard anybody say, oh, I found a great get-rich-quick scheme, you ought to get in on it? Nobody ever says that. They say, oh, I found a new strategy. I found some academic studies. You got to check this out. They've always got a storyline. Passive investing has a great storyline. It just, if you scrutinize it, it falls apart. That's the problem. But I was going to bring up that Taylor, you know, he recently had this thing where he said, oh, I had a plan B. You know, he never told anybody about plan B. He's been posting for 10 years. But his plan B is if stocks continue to go down, he's going to sell everything, go to a zero allocation. Taylor, for 10 years, stocks have been at insanely high prices. For the past, as long as Taylor's been writing on this board, the Vanguard Diehards board, and now the Bogleheads, over 10 years. I don't know when they started. I think it's been about 10 years. For that entire 10-year period, until the last 6 months, stocks were insanely overvalued, and he was telling people, go with a high stock allocation. Taylor is, I don't know what is, he's up there in years, I know. You know, I think he's in his early 80s. I'm not sure, but I know he's up there in his years. So many people would be saying he should be going with a low stock allocation, but he hasn't been. I don't know precisely what it is, but it's higher than most people would recommend for somebody his age. But he believes this stuff. So, you know, that's why. But now that it's failed, now he's saying, oh, I'm going to go to zero. Oh, it's, you know, I really wish that he could develop the humility to say, why is it that everything I do is always wrong? Why is it that I go with an insanely high stock allocation, a recklessly high stock allocation, when prices are high and the long-term value proposition is low, and then I go to an insanely low allocation when prices are good? But you see, if you can't accept the ambiguity that the market is partly rational and partly emotional, you'll be driven to that. What Taylor did was he ignored all the emotional part, all the valuations part. He doesn't want to know about it. Anybody brings up valuations is a troll in Taylor's thinking. A troll. So he tunes that out, and he goes with a purely rational approach, which is really rationalizing, because it doesn't take into account the most important factor. But it makes him feel comfortable, because that's you know, he's happy to discuss that side of things, happy to consider it. Well, he's always going to get it wrong, because he's making decisions that are highly confident of his decision. Because all the, you know, when the passive investors do these charts and tables, all the numbers add up, you know. The thinking doesn't add up, but the numbers sure add up. So they have high confidence. They've got numbers. And Taylor said this. People have said, why don't you allow other viewpoints to be discussed? He says, well, why should we? We're right. Why should we allow other people to express viewpoints when we're right? That's just how he thinks about it. He says, we're right. Why in the world would we allow somebody to say something that's wrong when we're right? But the problem is, the thinking goes around in circles. When you think you're right, that's when you're most wrong. When you think you can never be wrong, that's when you're totally wrong. It's dangerous, because there's no way to ever have a check on your thinking. That's why people get it wrong more than 50% of the time. We are drawn as human beings to, I don't know, dogmatism? And of course, why are we drawn to dogmatism? This would be the next question on the logic chain. Why? We're drawn to dogmatism out of fear. You know, people bring this up about religion. I am a person, I believe in God, but I strive not to be dogmatic about it. One of the things that I think keeps me from being too dogmatic is, you know, for 25 years, I didn't go to church. So if I were to say, you know, oh, those bad people, they don't go to church, you know, if I hear myself saying that, you know, I recall to mind that I am one of those bad people. And, you know, if those people are going to go to hell, well, I'm probably going to go to hell, you know, so maybe I better pull back a little bit. That would help an awful lot in the investing area if people could do that. If people could try to remember, you know, what I'm really about, what I really want to do over time is to come up with tools for helping people to avoid these mistakes so that they don't always get it wrong. And the tools are not tips. They're not investing tips. Tips don't work. The tools are process-oriented things. Things that will help you to rethink, to reconsider, to not become so dogmatic. So one thing to do, and I don't mean to pick on Taylor, but one thing that Taylor should try to do is say, is there anything in my life I've ever been wrong about? And surely there is something. Most of us are wrong about something on a weekly basis. Well, if you were wrong about that, isn't it possible you're wrong about passive investing too? And if there's any chance you're wrong, shouldn't you be open to hearing other viewpoints? Isn't it reckless to put your retirement money down on an idea that is so fragile that it can't be exposed to scrutiny? I think that would be a helpful mental exercise. For anyone who's lost money in the stock market, just think back. Is there anything you've ever been wrong about? So, you know, I can go through my life and you know, I can point to all kinds of things. I'll point to silly things. I don't care if they're silly. I think silly things make the point even stronger. Hey Jude, I brought this up once in a discussion board post. The Beatles came out with a single, Hey Jude and Revolution. And Hey Jude was the A side and Revolution was the flip. And I got the single and I said, what is this Hey Jude thing? You know, it goes on for 8 minutes and it's boring. And Revolution is hot. Why is that the flip? Doesn't make any sense. What were they thinking? And I was sort of angry about it. I mean, I was just a kid, but I was, you know, I guess I was about 12 years old, something like that. And I was angry. It's like, what were they thinking? They're so dumb. But now, years later, Hey Jude is one of my favorite songs of all time. And Revolution I still like, but I don't like it as much as Hey Jude. So I think they did the right thing. They picked the right song as the. But I didn't think that at that time. Another example along those same lines is the Beatles' White Album. The Beatles' White Album, when it came out, I listened to it every day, probably for 6 months. I listened to that album hundreds of times. And then there was one of these magazines, Mojo or something. It had a cover story a few years back when, I don't know, the 30th anniversary of the White Album, something like that. And they had a quote from Paul McCartney. And they were bringing up to him, the interviewer was bringing up that John Lennon said at the time the album came out, McCartney didn't like it. He said there aren't enough singles on it. And, you know, John Lennon was sort of chiding him about it. And so they said to McCartney, well, what do you think about this? You know, and McCartney said, well, can't we just say, oh, it's the White Album and just let it be at that? You know, he didn't want to say why he didn't think it was a good album. And that made me think, wait a minute, there must be something to this. And I went back and just looked at the, I didn't play it, but I just looked at the list of songs, and man, that album is awful. It's awful. I'm sorry. Now, you're allowed to have a different opinion, but I think it's awful. It's people, sometimes people will say about double albums, they'll say it would be good as a single album. That one would be good as a single. Forget a single album. There's awful stuff on that album. Don't Pass Me By is wretched. Cry Baby Cry is wretched. Honey Pie is wretched. Long, Long, Long is wretched. Continuing Story of Buffalo Bill is pretty darn close to wretched. That's a weak album. I love the Beatles, but that's a weak album. But the point is, I didn't think that at the time. I thought it was great. I listened to it every day. What was I thinking? We all get things wrong, and if we all could acknowledge that, now, not that that's so easy. Of course, the problem is when you think you're right, you think you're right. So how do you break that circle of dogmatism? That's what we need to become effective investors. That's the whole job. The whole job is to break that cycle of dogmatism because the information is there. We have a track record on stocks. We can look at how stocks have always performed. But if we can't hear the information, if we can't process it because we're caught up in our dogmatism, the information doesn't do us a bit of good. And that's where we are today. Where we are today is, you know, the passive investing is the worst investing strategy ever dreamed up by mankind because it is the most dogmatic. And the reason it is the most dogmatic is because it pretends to be science. In the years when passive investing was developed, it was a wonderful thing. What they were doing is they were taking the investing process and making it scientific. And that was great. That was a huge step forward. And there are insights that were developed by the people who developed passive investing that are outstanding insights. But they poisoned the whole thing by coming up with this idea that you don't need to change your stock allocation. They poisoned it. And there's been academic research now for almost 30 years showing that they were wrong about that, but they can't bring themselves to admit it. And the longer it goes on, the harder it is to admit, because the longer it goes on, the more human misery they cause by failing to admit the mistake. So instead of getting better, it gets worse. just like a human. But the point is, when you start thinking, you know, how is it that I always get it wrong? You need to pull back a little bit and say, wait a minute, maybe it's not just a joke. Maybe there's really something there. Maybe there's a reason why I always get it wrong. Bill Bangin is another example. Bill Bangin is the author of one of the old school safe withdrawal rate studies. He gets the numbers wrong in the study, just as John Graney does, just as Bill Scholler does, just as the Trinity people did, the Trinity study. And I wrote Bill about this, and Bill, financial planner out in California, and Bill, you know, I sort of like it that when stocks started falling in the crash, he said, I'm not going to, you know, his belief, you know, he's somewhat famous for this study, and all of his teachings for years say you have to stay in stocks when prices drop. None of the old school studies work at all if you don't do that. I mean, even John Graney will agree with me on that one. He'll agree with me right down the line. That one thing I like about John Graney is that he's wrong and he's abusive, but he believes in intellectual consistency more than most of his supporters do. And John has never said that John is the only person I know who has never said that the old school studies give a rule of thumb. You know, John Graney says they're right, period. I sort of like that about him. He's wrong. I don't agree with him. But I like it that he sort of understands that intellectual consistency is important. He's not willing to apply it in this particular case, but he gets the principle. Anyway, you know, Bangin abandoned intellectual consistency. He said, oh, I'm not going to let my clients lose all their money. I'm taking them out of stocks. And he took his clients down to zero stocks. So Bangin abandoned passive investing completely. You know, he violated the first principle, but he won't admit that. He still says he's a passive investor, but he has no idea how he's going to know when to get back in the market. Now, this is another example. This guy, he's smart as the Dickens. You know, that's not a problem. But he's gotten it wrong. And I think he's going to get it wrong again. You know what I can see happening to Bill? And I think I mentioned this in an earlier podcast. He's now down to zero stocks. He's obviously not going to stay at zero stocks forever. You know, what kind of financial planner would you be if your clients are always at zero stocks? So he's going to have to get back in. What I can see happening is the P10 level starts to go up gradually over the next few years. We're now at 14. We go to 17, 18, whatever. And then he says, okay, the crisis is over. You can get back in. He gets his clients back in stocks. And then we have the next price crash, the next leg of this thing. And there's another 50% drop or a 60% drop. Then he goes to zero permanently. You know, then they all fire him, you know. So he would have gotten it wrong at every stage. He had them over-invested in stocks when prices were insanely high. He got them down to zero stocks when prices returned to reasonable levels. Then he got them back in stocks when prices got dangerous again. Then he gets them back out again when they return to, you know, better than reasonable prices. How could he get it wrong at every possible mark? How could you get it wrong every time? It defies the odds, doesn't it? It defies the probabilities. Well, the answer is, if you've got some approach to stock investing where, you know, you think the market price is always right, you'll always get it wrong because that premise is just false. If you're thinking the market is 100% rational and you're ignoring the emotional content, then what's going to happen is, you see, the emotional content affects Bill Bangin and it affects Taylor Larimore and it affects me and it affects you. The emotional content affects us. So passive investing says tune that out. Pay no attention to it. Well, that doesn't make the that doesn't mean it's less of a factor. It's still every bit as much of a factor. It's just that we're not paying attention to it. It's sort of like you're driving down the road and you're saying, you know, I could get to my destination quicker if I didn't stop at red lights. And you say, I know what I'll do. I'll just pretend I don't see them. I'll roll right on through the red lights. You might get away with that for the first few red lights, but sooner or later you're going to be a head-on collision. It's not going to work. That's what passive investing is. Passive investing says ignore the red lights. Sure, common sense tells you you should lower your stock allocation when prices become insanely dangerous, but you don't have to do that. You can just tune it out. If you tune it out, you know, 96, prices were insanely dangerous. People tuned it out. They didn't get hurt. 97, same thing. 98, they went through red lights. They didn't get killed. But now they got killed. Sooner or later, they were going to get killed. It was just a question of time. The reason why we can get it all wrong is that humans seem to have a desire to think either that things are rational or that things are emotional. We tend to think of something like, you know, if we're choosing a mate, we're choosing a life partner. We tend to think of that as an emotional, something in the emotional category. Not many people would say, I mean, some people might do a list of pros and cons, you know, of a particular life partner, but most people don't take that too seriously. You know, they'll put something like that in a magazine, but most people don't take it too seriously. We sort of go by our emotions. We go by our gut. There are certain traits we're looking for that are rational. You know, you probably wouldn't date someone if they couldn't hold a job, or, you know, maybe if they were an alcoholic or something. But in general, you know, we don't say the person has to be such and such. You know, we're going by feel. There's certain things, certain traits we're looking for, but it's much more an emotional decision. But if we're trying to put together a bicycle, you know, we want instructions. You know, this part goes here, and you put this screw in here. We don't want anybody to say, let me tell you about the feelings of the bicycle. You know, I got a feeling this part ought to go here. You know, we don't want to hear your feelings. We want to know what works. So we've got these realms that are practical and rational, where rationality works, and we've got these realms where emotion works. Songs are emotional. People don't listen to songs. Who can say why a certain song is their favorite song? Get Back is my favorite song, one of my favorites. I think Mrs. Robinson is really my favorite of all time, the Simon and Garfunkel song. Mrs. Robinson is my favorite song, and Get Back is second. Blind Willie McTell is third. Those are my favorite songs. Now, somebody will say, Mrs. Robinson, I hate that song. What do you like about that song? Well, it speaks to me for God knows what reason. But it's not, you know, I could do a podcast, God help us all. I could do a podcast on why I like that song, and I could give you reasons. But it would, you know, it ultimately, it's more emotional than it is rational. You know, it's or maybe emotions have a certain reason to them. Maybe I think sometimes that's what I sort of believe, that emotions are sometimes almost an intuition. They're almost an instinct. That what they're doing is we you know, you look at somebody's face, they make a certain facial expression, and it gives you the creeps. And you couldn't write down why. You don't really know why. But it's not that you're stupid. It's that. Your life experiences have led you to believe that a certain facial expression is a bad sign. There's wisdom in emotion, I think. I think there's wisdom in emotion, often. That doesn't mean it's always right. Emotion can mislead you just as reason can mislead you. What are the questions that comes into play here? In other words, what I'm saying here is the reason why we get investing wrong so often is we don't understand that it's both emotion and reason working together, and to a large extent, we don't always trust emotion. We especially in the investing realm, we don't trust emotion. We think of it as a realm where that should be reasonable, And so we look for reasonable explanations, and that gets us into trouble, because while it's good to look for reasonable explanations, it's bad to make a fetish of it. You have to balance the two. So one of the questions that comes up is emotion a better guide to behavior, or is reason a better guide? And that's a very deep, I think, a very deep philosophical question. And lots of people think reason is better. There was a thread very early in the Great Safe Withdrawal Rate debate at the Motley Fool Board. It was very early. The discussion started on May 13th, 2002. This thread started. My guess is it might have started on May 15th. The first week, I'm pretty sure. And John Graney was saying I was irrational. You know, I was questioning the old school safe withdrawal rate studies, and that showed I was irrational. And not just me, all the people who were agreeing with me. They're all irrational. He's rational. And there was a woman poster, Friendly Girl, was her screen name, and she was a friendly girl. She was always trying to make peace. And she was saying, you know, Rob, you make some good points, and you know, John makes good points, and you know, sort of like we should all just try to work this out. And I was saying, well, it's sort of hard to work it out when there's such dogmatism. You know, John is saying his approach is the only rational approach. You know, I'm willing to say John's smart. I'm willing to say he's entitled to his opinion. I'm willing to be his friend. But I'm not willing to say I think he's the only person who has a rational understanding of investing. And she said, you know, so this thread came up, irrational question mark. And she said, is irrational necessarily bad? You know, maybe it's good to be irrational. And that was more than I could swallow. I know that John meant it as an insult. That I'm sure of. He meant it as an insult. And I think most people take it that way. To say that your investing ideas are irrational is an insult. And that's what the passive investors do. There was another guy who had a blog, and I can't recall the name of it now, but he basically wrote, I wrote a riff on that at my blog one time. This guy said, people who don't believe in passive investing are irrational. Irrational investors. But I do think that there is some merit in the idea of being quote unquote irrational at times. What I think is it's irrational to think that you're totally rational. I understand that's a paradoxical statement, but anyone who thinks they are 100% rational is, in my view, by definition, irrational, because none of us are. And you're just fooling yourself. And when you fool yourself that way, that's how you can always get it wrong. You're living in denial of the realities that humans are in part emotional. So I think good decisions come about through a combination of rationality and emotion. And one of the questions I sometimes, when I'm not thinking about safe withdrawal rates, I'm usually thinking about God and where I'm going to end up. And one of the questions that comes up in the Catholic faith is there's two great doctors of the Catholic, doctors of the Church. Thomas Aquinas, who wrote these long books filled with logic chains, you know, Summa Theologica. And he's considered the doctor of the Church, the sort of the smartest person who ever wrote Church doctrine, Catholic theology. And then there's St. Augustine, who was a different sort of individual. St. Augustine was also very smart, and he also wrote lots of great things. But Augustine tended to come at things through the heart rather than the brain. And Augustine is my kind of guy, and I named my boy. His middle name is Augustine. I didn't want to give him that. I felt that was too much to give it as his first name, but Robert's middle name is Augustine, after St. Augustine. But St. Augustine had two wonderful things that I use as a guide. And one, I think it's one of the funniest lines I've ever heard. I don't think everybody else thinks it's as funny as I do, but I get a tremendous kick out of it. But St. Augustine's prayer. St. Augustine was a great sinner. And he was trying to convert. You know, he was trying to change. And he had a prayer. And he says, "Dear God, please make me chaste, but not just yet." And that's the Rob Bennett prayer. I'm very much into that. It's like, "Dear God, you know, I want to be a good person. Please make me a good person. But, you know, no hurry. You know, take your time. You know, there's no rush here. There's no rush here. I don't want to give this stuff up just yet." That's my kind of prayer. Because what I love about it is it's got, I said this to the kids. I mean, I changed it a little bit, but I said to the kids in my catechism class this past week, and I changed it. I didn't say, "Make me chaste." I said, "Dear God, make me good, but not just yet." But I don't think they got it. They looked at me with sort of puzzled faces, and I thought, maybe I'm going too advanced. But in my mind, see, that's saying, "Dear God, make me chaste or make me good, but not just yet." That to me is wisdom. Because the guy is saying, "I want to be good," and that's a good thing, you know. But of course he's not being hypocritical. He's acknowledging that he's not good, and he's also acknowledging that there's a part of him that doesn't want to be good. And that's at least honest, and I think honesty gets you to the better place rather than denial. You know, the other way would be to say, "Oh, I want to be all good, and I'm pious, and I pray all the time." And then you just block out of your mind all the sins you commit. You know, you have unkind thoughts about your neighbor, and you just, "Oh, well, he deserves it. He really is bad. You know, I'm not bad. He's bad." So Augustine's approach appeals to me, sort of this mixed approach. And he had another line where he said, love God and all else follows. You know, he's not saying to ignore the commandments. He's saying love God and you're going to want to do his commandments. You know, it's not going to be a question of you're following the commandments because you feel you have to obey. It's going to be because you want to. You love God. You love goodness. So I get to, you know, whatever little religion I have in my life, I get to it by means of the heart rather than by means of the mind. And I think that's what's lacking in Investo world. Investo world has been overrun by rationalists. And, you know, God bless them. We need them. Never have you heard Rob Bennett say he wants to exclude the rationalist. Never have you heard me say we should ban discussions of passive investing or advocacy of passive investing. Some of these people are giants in the field, and I've learned from them, and I consider them friends. Because of what I've learned from them, you know, I always respect somebody I learned something from, and a lot of the leading figures who advocate passive investing are people I've learned important things from. So I'm always going to feel fond of them regardless of how much human misery they cause. But you see, I'm going to tell both sides. I'm always going to say they're great, and I'm always going to say they've caused great human misery by their bullheaded unwillingness to acknowledge the failings of this discredited model. You know, it hasn't been discredited for 6 months. It's been discredited for close to 30 years now. I remember back when I was putting together my retire early plan. This was mid to late 90s. And I was in Borders, and I used to go to Borders and look for books on this subject. And I used to literally go book by book. You know, I'd go to the economics section or the investing section, and I would just, I would start at the A, you know, and I'd just go through book by book. I was determined to find things. And I'd look for things I hadn't seen. And there was a book on investing, and I recall the title. I'm pretty sure this was the title: The Case Against the Efficient Market Theory. And I didn't buy it. At the time, I was like everybody else. I figured, oh, all these experts, they say the market's efficient. They must be right, you know. But I thought it was a good title. I thought, boy, that's interesting. Could it be that this theory is wrong? That's an interesting idea. And I was tempted to buy it, but I had too many other things I wanted to read, and so I didn't. But of course, years later, I now believe the efficient market theory is a big bunch of hooey. You know, it's nonsense. But all these big, highfalutin people, they're so sure. They're so sure of it. What they need, you see, they need humility. We don't need to do away with their intelligence. Their intelligence is a big plus. But they need some humility to counter it. And they need to open up. They need to feel more comfortable with feeling. That's really the way to counter it. Because, see, feeling is often counter to your heart, often is counter to what your mind tells you. And you have to listen to both sides. And humans are just both. There's just no way of getting around it. We are not robots. If all we did was respond to data, we would be robots. And we're not. It's a lie. Anybody who tells you that, it's a lie. And we're not just feeling. You know, anybody who tells you don't need to pay attention to human reason is also making you inhuman. That's why I call the book I'm working on Investing for Humans. Humans have two sides, the rational and the emotional. And any investing theory that only has one side is gravely flawed. So flawed, it cannot be fixed. It has to be replaced. That's passive investing. It's all rationalizing. There's no room in it for feeling. There's no room in it for consideration of valuations, which are the result of emotions. So instead of being the best investing theory of all time, which is it is advertised as being, it's the worst. Because it's good enough to persuade people. It's good enough to sound plausible, but it's got this core flaw in it that causes it to be always wrong, always good enough to persuade you, always wrong enough to give you the wrong answer. And that's how it can be that whatever you decide to do turns out to be wrong. If you adopt this as your model, it's always going to be leading you the wrong way. Is there a different model you can adopt where it will always lead you to be the right way? I think there is, although there's no model that's always going to get it right. See, what there is there's a model, and I call it rational investing, which encourages you to counter your reason with your emotion and counter your emotion with your reason. It's not always going to get it right because it's more a process than it is a substantive answer model. It doesn't tell you what to do. It tells you how to go about doing it. And to the extent you pull it off, you'll be okay. But you're not always going to pull it off perfectly. I'll give you an example. Of how you could analyze something under the rational model, the rational investing model, and have a better chance of getting the answer right. And the question is, should you now be heavily invested in stocks? The P10 value is now 14. If you look at that in terms of the numbers, the answer is yes. Look at the stock return predictor. Look at the returns you get when the P10 value is 14, and you'll see the long-term value proposition of stocks is very good. Now, the concern that you should have is, isn't there a chance we're going to have another 50% price drop? And the answer to that is yes. We've been at insanely high valuation levels three times, and on each of those three occasions, we fell to P10 values far lower than where we are today, about 50% lower. So if you go by those three occasions, you're going to say, no, I'm going to wait. I'm going to wait. I understand the value proposition's good, but it'll be even better after we fall 50%. So I'm going to wait, and then I'll get in. Now, the logic there is strong, and you're taking valuations into account, so it could be argued that you're not ignoring the emotional side. The flaw is that you're making a decision based on only three tests. And that's why the market always teaches you a lesson. That's why you always get things wrong. We tend to jump to conclusions. The fact that three times in the past the P10 value dropped by another 50% does not mean that's going to happen this time. It certainly could. I certainly wouldn't rule it out. The odds are probably better than 50%. But what if there's always something different about each scenario. This time valuations were higher than ever. And this time, the middle class was more invested in stocks than ever before. So the pain this time is greater, possibly, than any of the three earlier times. If the pain is greater, that may mean that we will abandon the emotional approach and we will adopt rational investing before we see another 50% price drop. If that happens, we don't need to see a 50% price drop. So I can imagine a scenario in which we don't fall any further. I wouldn't bet a whole lot of money on it. I think the odds are we probably will go lower, but I can see a scenario in which we won't. And so what you have to do is you have to sort of hedge your bets. You have to, you know, you want to go with a high enough stock allocation so that if we don't go lower, you're going to participate in the good returns. And yet, you don't want to put everything into stocks because there is a chance we're going to go lower and you want to have something left to put in then. Hedging your bets, that's a concept that is core to the rational investing model. It's always about hedging your bets. That's why I say what we need in investing is emotional balance. Well, the way that emotional balance reflects itself in investor behavior is through hedging of bets. When you say, well, it could go this way, it could go that way, you say, well, maybe my allocation should be 60% stocks, not 80, not 20. Maybe it should be 60. That's hedging your bets. That's emotionally healthy investing. The problem, why is it we always get it wrong? Why is it that we don't see that? The market's been teaching us that for as long as it's been around. So why don't we all do that? Because there's something in human nature that says, I want to go with 20 or 80. I want to go with 20 or 80. I don't want to go with 60. Why? 60 is uncomfortable. 60 means you don't know what's going to happen and you're acknowledging it. You're acknowledging it with your behavior. Your behavior is saying, if hedging your bets means you don't know what's going to happen. We want to know. We're scared. We're scared. And we want to know how it's going to turn out. And so we insist on it. We say, I'll go with 20. I can live with that. That means I'm predicting a lower prices. Or I'll go with 80. I'm predicting we're not going to go any lower. But I can't live with the uncomfortable feeling of not being sure. I can't live with 60 or 50. It's got to be 20 or 80. Can't be 50 or 60. That's the human animal. That's your enemy. That's what I call dogmatism. That need to know the answer. That need to have... The answer, I believe, is a greater level of self-awareness. The market has a brain. It's our brain. The trouble is that we have not, in the past, addressed stock investing questions on a two-level basis. We need to be thinking... See, even when we use the word thinking, we get ourselves into trouble. But we need to be analyzing things both from an emotional and from a rational standpoint at all times. What's going on is that the market price is it's the result of these two competing forces. And only over time can we look back and see whether it's our emotional side or our rational side that's been dominant at any given time. If you go back to January of 2000 and put the PE10 level that applied at that time into the stock return predictor, you'll see that investing in stocks at that time was crazy. The long-term value proposition was a negative number. It made no sense to be putting your money into this high-risk asset class that was likely going to provide a negative long-term return. If we were purely rational, that reality would have evidenced itself in behavior instantly. We would have instantly sold stocks until prices came down low enough to make the long-term value proposition an appealing proposition once again. But what happens instead is that our emotions and our reason go into battle. They went into battle beginning in January of 2000. So that over time, Over time, what our reason told us brought prices down, so they're now much lower. We're now at a PE10 level of 14, in contrast to the PE10 level of 44 that applied in January of 2000. So over time, the market, our intelligence has been incorporated into the market price, but our emotions have been fighting it every inch of the way. The answer to all of our stock investing problems is self-awareness. When we become aware of the role that our emotions play, it becomes possible to incorporate that into our thinking. When we become aware of the way in which reason and emotions do battle, we can understand why the market is not instantly efficient, as the passive investing model says, but does indeed have a tendency towards efficiency, and over time does indeed always become efficient. You see, what's happening today is that efficiency is hurting us. We think that the market is instantly efficient. It's not. But yet it's true that the market is becoming efficient, and that process of becoming efficient is crushing us, because we are acting as if the market is totally efficient from the first day. We're investing as if we were already there. We're investing as if prices had already been reduced when they haven't been. And we're suffering because we're not aware of this battle taking place between reason and emotion. So the answer is self-awareness. The answer is that we need to acknowledge the mistakes of the past, and then we need to just openly discuss them and openly discuss why it is that we made these mistakes and what we need to do to protect ourselves from falling into these traps again in the future. The answer is self-awareness. That's what rational investing is really all about. I'd love to hear feedback. If you have thoughts about this podcast, please send me a note. Contact me by looking for the Contact Rob button at the left side of every page at the website. Good luck with your investing strategies. You take care.